Good morning and welcome to the KUNM Call-In Show. I'm your host, Kathleen Sabo. Many New Mexicans breathed a sigh of relief when the government shutdown ended last week, and many suffered from the shutdown and are now looking to recover. Others are looking at how New Mexico can move forward in ways that will strengthen our economy and provide opportunities and well-being for our citizens. Joining me in the studio today to look at these issues and more is New Mexico's United States Senator Martin Heinrich. Welcome to you this morning, Senator.
It's always great to be here.
It's wonderful to have you. We've wanted to have you in our studio and on this program for some time. We appreciate you taking the time to join us and to have a discussion with our listeners. What brings you back to New Mexico this visit?
Just an opportunity to meet with some folks in state, to do some tours and get around the state and do a little press. And just the normal what I had planned to be doing about a week and a half ago when the government shutdown sort of took over everyone's lives and took us on a grand detour.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that grand detour. Just a little more than a week ago, you delivered a speech on the Senate floor underlining the devastating impacts of the, at that time, ongoing government shutdown on New Mexico's economy and middle-class families. People can visit your website to read the text or watch the video of the speech. But one of the big takeaways from your speech, as well as from the shutdown itself on the and the ongoing sequestration cuts, is how dependent we are as a state on federal dollars, either because we have 27,000 federal workers in New Mexico or federal grants and contracts that fund state and local health care, transportation, education, housing programs,
right,
et cetera. When we explored the shutdown and its impact on our October 3rd show, we wondered whether there could be anything positive for the state that results from the shutdown and whether this spotlight on federal dependence could act as a catalyst for increased diversification of our state economy. I'd love for you to weigh in on those questions, please, Senator.
Well, it certainly shines a light on the fact that we do a lot of work in New Mexico in the service of the rest of the country. And some of that is absolutely fantastic work. I mean, we have some of the greatest summer vacation spots in the world right here in our own backyard that protect our culture and our public lands. But we do need to diversify our economy. There's no question. I'm proud of the 27,000 federal workers we have. They go to work. They work hard. They believe in service to our country. But we can do a lot more to make sure that we also have the kinds of businesses that we should have that have no direct connection to federal dollars, and we need to do more to diversify, to take advantage of some of the inherent things that we have here in New Mexico that are so special. I've done a lot of work over the last few years on energy transmission, on renewable energy transmission, and trying to get the kind of infrastructure that will allow additional private sector development, construction jobs, the kinds of things that aren't tied directly to the ups and downs of a federal budget.
Well, and just to step back for a second, those 27,000 federal workers, was there legislation passed that will provide retroactive pay for
Absolutely.
Them?
Absolutely, and that's something that our delegation fought very hard for, something I feel particularly proud of. There is actually a little bit of a COLA raise, a cost of living adjustment for those federal workers who have seen no raises in years and years because of the challenges with our federal budget. And so, federal workers tend to take it on the chin sometimes. But when you get to know the people who are working at the Social Security Administration or at Indian Health Services who do so much work for so little thanks, they really are, they're the people who make our country work. And I'm grateful to them.
Well, you have a wealth of issues listed as priorities on your website, but I know the issue which you have described as being your focus is restoring the middle class and growing the economy. So what does that entail, and how do we go about doing that in New Mexico?
Well, I really worry that if we don't get some of our policy choices right over the next decade or so, that we could be the first generation in this country that could see our kids not inherit a brighter economic future than we inherited from our parents. It's getting more and more expensive to go to college. We are seeing concentration of wealth like we've never seen before in this country. And there are lots of little things sort of chipping away at the middle class. And I think it's an important time to take stock and to focus on what provides that sort of middle-class stability in the heart of the country that's made our country so strong for over 200 years, and how do we reinforce that and strengthen it and make it relevant to the future. And that means we're going to have to get some things right in the next few years. Not only some traditional things like just making sure that the minimum wage keeps up with inflation, but making sure that college is more accessible. If we have a situation in this country where people are opting out of going to higher education simply because they can't afford it, we will be in deep trouble 20 years from now.
Well, this is a rich topic. So just to start, how do you define the middle class?
You know, I don't spend a lot of time sort of wrestling with, is it at this income level or that income level? But we have always been a country where people could grow up and get a good education, go to work and provide for their kids and hope that their kids were going to have more opportunities than they did. And where, you know, where people are in a situation where they can meet the basic requirements of being able to think about the well-being of their family. So able to buy a home, for example, if that is out of reach for more and more Americans, then I think we're failing on that vision of what the middle class should be and who we should be looking out for in this country.
So sort of out of survival mode and into
out of survival mode and planning for the well-being of their family, thinking about, okay, how am I going to be able to take care of myself in retirement? How am I going to make sure that my kids have the opportunities that they deserve? And keeping, you know, just a decent roof over your head. The basics, nothing fancy. I mean, I grew up in a double-wide trailer, and, you know, we never had a lot, but we always had food on the table. And my parents always made it clear that they would do whatever it took to give me the opportunity to go to college. I think that's very important that we have hope on the horizon for anybody who wants to get ahead and to do something more.
Now, you talked about the minimum wage. And as you know, here in New Mexico, we've had several cities, whether it's Santa Fe or Albuquerque, work to address that issue on their own. But is there something happening at the federal level as well?
There is a groundswell at the federal level, and it hasn't received a lot of press attention. But myself and a number of my colleagues have been working on legislation that would raise the minimum wage to over $10 an hour. It's gaining co-sponsors. And, you realize how important it is when you see these stories about companies who are paying their employees so little that they're having to do trainings on how to get government assistance, how to sign up for Medicaid, how to get assistance funds in terms of welfare or TANF or other things. And it's because they're not paying their employees enough to have they're not paying them a livable wage. And I think that's a real problem. We need to make sure that minimum wage is something that keeps up with the times. And it's just a floor. There are so many more things that that come from that. But it does put people in a position where they can provide for themselves, and that's only right.
Well, the stories that tend to make the news these days are about the outliers, the companies that do take care of their employees, whether it's Costco or
right.
In-N-Out
yep.
Burger or,
exactly.
or something like that.
And ironically, it's good business. You know, they have a loyalty in their employees. They don't have the turnover. And as a result, many of those businesses are outperforming their competitors because they're not in a race to the bottom.
Well, where does the pushback come against? Where does it come from against raising the federal minimum or the minimum wage?
Today, there is a substantial number of people, particularly in the House of Representatives, who have such a laissez-faire view of the economy that they don't believe there should be a federal minimum wage. And it's some of the same folks that you saw dig in over the government shutdown and try to use whether or not the government stays open as a bargaining chip for other ideological goals, you know, whether it's getting rid of the Affordable Care Act or anything else. And so that's who we're up against in this battle. And I think, you know, it's absolutely appropriate that we should have those floors within our society. There's a reason why we have a 40-hour work week, why we have things like, you know, child labor laws, and why you have to pay somebody overtime if they work more than 40 hours a week.
You know, and I look at what you say about the pushback coming from people who want the market to be free and to operate freely. And I just think about the opinion people have of Congress people as a whole right now, and the fact that if the free market dictated pay for Congress people. So people tend to forget, you know, there's support along the lines everywhere at all different levels comes from the government. Let's talk a little bit about college affordability, because we've done a couple of shows here where we've talked about the staggering debt that people have when they leave college, whether it's in New Mexico or elsewhere. How do we go about addressing that?
Well, I think we took an incremental step in that direction here a couple of months ago, where we were able to move forward in a way that kept college loans much lower than they would have doubled. But it was just an incremental step. And I think we need to view college affordability as a major investment. You know, we have over the years built our entire economy around substantial investments in three major areas, in education, in research, and in infrastructure. And when you put back in those three areas within your economy, it creates all kinds of efficiencies down the road. And making sure that people can have that pathway to higher education, or for that matter, that pathway to training and job training and technical vocational skills, those are things that pay enormous dividends for our economy. And we're not doing that. We're not viewing that as an investment right now. And I think it's one of those areas where we should choose to spend tax dollars. And you know, there were some when we had the debate over college affordability and we were able to come to a compromise that kept the rates low in the short term and tied them to the T-bills, there were some of us who said, we need to do more. And I hope that over time there will be more and more serving in the House and Senate who take that view, because it's one of the things that really has made this country great, is our investment in education and in the idea that it's not just education for a few or education for the privileged. It should be education for anyone who wants to better themselves. And that goes back to this idea of a strong middle class, is you have to have accessibility for everyone.
All right. If you would like to join in our discussion with United States Senator Martin Heinrich, and we invite you to do so, there are several ways for you to participate. You may email comments to callinshow@kunm.org. You may post comments on the Call In Show webpage at kunm.org. Or you may call our local number, 277-5866, that's 277-KUNM, or our toll-free number, 1-877-899-5866, with questions and comments. So, Senator, before we go to a very short break, just so people can understand a little bit more about you, what are your specific committee assignments in D.C.?
So I sit on a number of different committees. Right now I'm on Commerce, on the Joint Economic Committee, which is a House-Senate committee, on Intelligence, and on Energy and Natural Resources. And Energy and Natural Resources is probably the committee where I do the most things that are directly applicable and relevant to the state of New Mexico. Obviously, we have energy interests in the state that run the gamut from the most traditional to the most cutting edge. It's a committee that has the jurisdiction over our public lands. People don't realize that in the state of New Mexico, we have 68,000 jobs directly tied to the recreation that goes on in those public lands. Some of the best rural jobs in the state. I was talking to an outfitter guide from northern New Mexico recently who makes six figures in a good year, basically taking people out on those public lands. All of those kinds of it's a committee where I can touch things that are tangible to the state of New Mexico on a regular basis. And so I spend a lot of time focusing on energy and natural resources.
And your other committee assignments that you didn't mention?
Intelligence, Joint Economic, and Commerce.
Okay. All right. Well, we're going to go to a short break now. We're talking with Senator Martin Heinrich. And when we come back, we will take your calls.
This Week in This American Life. For 22 years, a guy gets jobs as Linnell Hudson. He gets married as Linnell Hudson, has kids as Linnell Hudson, until he's arrested. for stealing that name and a Social Security number from somebody else. He's convicted. And game's up, right? No.
I think he's used that identity for so long that he really thought that's who he was.
That's this week.
Sunday afternoons at 4 on KUNM.
I put my hands on her throat and start choking her.
Next time on Peace Talks Radio, a Minnesota program that helps offending men face up to their domestic violence behavior.
It made me realize how far I could have went.
We can't look at that slap in isolation, that there's a whole lineage of men's entitlement over women that's historical.
Some hopeful progress in addressing domestic violence next time on Peace Talks Radio.
Friday morning at 8 on 89.9 KUNM.
Welcome back to the KUNM Call-In Show. I'm Kathleen Sabo, and I'm joined in the studio by United States Senator Martin Heinrich, who's here to have a discussion with us and take your questions and comments. And at this point, Senator, let's go to our first call. It's Bill from Los Lunas. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning. Good morning, Senator.
Good morning, Bill.
How you doing?
Great.
Senator, the future of our children is the main pedestal that we all strive for. However, regardless of their education, regardless of their employment in the future, nothing compares to this unless we handle the environment. Without a good environment, our future is bleak. We in New Mexico gave our shirts off our back to private companies like Intel. We gave them free land. We gave them stuff at a dollar price and stuff. And now Intel is rewarding us back with 200 employee layoff. That's what is wrong with our system here in New Mexico. We have mayors, we have a governor now that looks for employees all over the world before they look at the employees of New Mexico for high-level jobs. That's our problem with the economy. We have an economy in the United States that is destroying the world, and yet we want to double it, triple it, quadruple it. I don't see it. Your comments, sir. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill.
Thanks, Bill. And first, let me just say I very much take the view that the economy and the environment are not in odds. And if you look at the places around the world that have the healthiest economies, they tend to take good care of their environment. And we certainly should here, because our outdoors and this special place that is New Mexico is a huge part of what is attractive and economically viable about this state. People who bring small businesses here, who start web-based businesses, and you know, people come here because of the environment and the quality of life. And I take the view that the biggest challenge, because I talk to a lot of people in high-tech businesses, CEOs with companies all across the country, and one of our challenges, not the tax incentives that you can give to a big corporation to try and make New Mexico look better than other places. And you can chase that to its logical end, and to some degree it's a race to the bottom. But it is workforce training that most large employers are looking for. They're looking for a qualified workforce. And if you can provide that, if you can make sure that kids as early as elementary school have a focus on STEM education, and then you stick with that all the way through either their vocational training or their higher education in college, and you have that workforce, you attract high-quality employers from all over the country and all over the world. And that's the kind of investment that I think we should be making. We should be investing in our environment, and we should be investing in our children.
All right, let's go to our next caller. It's Judy from Albuquerque. Good morning, Judy.
Hi. Good morning.
Hi, Judy.
Hi. Good morning. Thank you. I'm sorry. I wasn't quite right at the phone. My question, beautiful economy, beautiful environment. How is that going to be sustained if we have an aquifer that's poisoned from Sandia Labs and Kirtland Air Force Base? And how on earth are we going to get the money to remediate that when the government is so dysfunctional?
Or go right ahead, Senator.
Well, this is an issue, and I'm assuming you're talking about the Kirtland Air Force spill, which is a huge issue. It was Senator Bingaman and I who first pulled Air Force leadership together and said, you've got to fix this. This is one of the biggest threats to Albuquerque's aquifer that we've ever seen. And, you know, that is going to be one of those issues that is going to require a long-term commitment. And it's one of the reasons why we cannot afford the kind of dysfunctionality that we're seeing in the government right now. We're also, it's one of the reasons why we cannot balance our budget simply on the discretionary part of the budget. We can't just keep cutting at environmental remediation and education and all those parts of the budget and think that we're going to have a healthy economy and going to be able to meet challenges like we have with the fuel spill. We're going to continue to push on that front, but frankly, we need a functional government year after year and real budgets, and that's going to necessitate some compromise.
And Judy, are you still with us? No, Judy is gone. Well, Judy, do you live in an area where you feel you might be directly impacted by that spill?
Well, sure, I live in Albuquerque, New Mexico. what's going on under the ground, unseen and unreported, is a poisoning of the water supply.
All right.
That it's unreported. I mean, this has been well known and on the front page of the Albuquerque Journal and many other places for years and years, since I was actually on the Albuquerque Bernalillo County Water Authority. And the spill is closest. My water that I got up this morning and turned on the tap and comes from the Burton Well in southeast Albuquerque, which is one of the closest wells to that spill. I think everybody who lives anywhere near it takes it very, very seriously, and all of us should. One of the things I would like to see is a more aggressive attempt to remediate it that probably necessitates some technology that looks at pump and treat, as well as the kind of sparging technology and the other things, the strippers that they've been employing so far. But that also requires additional cooperation with New Mexico's Environment Department.
All right, Judy, thanks so much for your call. You talked about how we need a functioning government, one that doesn't govern crisis to crisis. And we had a debt ceiling raise that ended the shutdown, but just a
cushion.
You know,
we should talk a little bit about the debt ceiling, because I think a lot of people don't understand what that is. If a lot of people think that the debt ceiling is us taking on new debt. It is not. It's a commitment to pay the bills that we've already incurred. It's kind of like if you have a mortgage, the people who say don't raise the debt ceiling, the analogy would be you take out a mortgage on a nice new house, and then you decide, oh, it's too much debt, so I'm going to send a note in this month that says I'm not paying the mortgage. The right way to get your finances in order is through the budget and the appropriations process by increasing revenues and making cuts where appropriate. Not raising the debt ceiling simply has the impact of making us default on our debts. If you default, then your credit rating is ruined. Everybody wants to charge you, for every 1% increase in interest rates, our debt actually explodes because we don't have the same credit rating because we're not paying off our debts. And so I think it's important for people to realize that those of us who say that we have to make sure that the full faith and credit of the United States is never questioned, it's not because we want to see the debt increase. It's because we want to see us get our debt under control and to be a country that is respected economically throughout the world and doesn't have runaway inflation.
Well, this deal that was just struck to get the government to open again, it's just a short-term solution, is my understanding. Were there protections put into place, though, at the time? I remember reading something about that. Are we looking at a very likely repeat of the same scenario come January or February?
I was one of the people who said it's absolutely unacceptable to first off play politics with shutting down the government. I think those who really reveled at the idea of shutting down the government, it was a small group of people, but they had an enormous amount of influence. It was a handful of senators and a small caucus that, colloquially, is now kind of called the Kamikaze Caucus in the House of Representatives, that said this is the right way for us to get things that we don't have the votes to get to otherwise. And I think the rest, I really don't blame Republicans, because many of them said this is a terrible, terrible strategy. It was this small Tea Party Kamikaze Caucus that led us down this pathway. And I think that their colleagues who bore the brunt of the rightful frustration that the country had with these tactics have learned their lesson. I don't think we're going to see another shutdown. I've seen many, many of my Republican colleagues say we're never going there again. But it doesn't mean we're out of the woods in terms of coming up with the long-term budget strategy where we come together and we make some compromises to get to a budget that puts us on a pathway to better investments and to lower deficits.
Why did we come to a shutdown now? I mean, for years have always been Republicans and Democrats, different ideas about how to handle budget matters. What brought us to that precipice that was new?
It was the introduction of some new people into the mix. And, you know, my colleague, Senator Cruz from Texas, Senator Lee from Utah, and others who thought that they could accomplish something, that being repealing the Affordable Care Act, through budget negotiations and through threatening to shut down the government and not pay our debt, that they couldn't accomplish through the regular order of getting the votes together for it. And it was a terrible strategy, and it hurt a lot of people. And at the end of the day, they probably got a worse deal than they could have got the night before the shutdown if they would have come to the table and been serious about their negotiations.
Well, a deal is one thing, but affecting people's lives back in people's home states or even throughout the country is another thing. And I don't know what they thought they were playing with or who they thought they were playing with.
You know, a lot of their rhetoric is around restoring the economy, but we took a $24 billion hit to the economy for this misguided and irresponsible diversion. And it's so frustrating because we have an economy that has slowly kind of recovered from the depths of where it was a few years ago. But the growth has been slow, and anything you do to pull back from that now really causes major problems. And we finally have seen some fundamentals in the economy start to heat up and the housing market start to recover a little bit. But every time we have one of these manufactured crises, it sets the clock back months. And we're holding our own success back.
You know, we'd be remiss if we didn't acknowledge that there were not people who supported the actions that were taken by the people in Congress. I don't know what those numbers are, but what do you say to those people who now feel sort of doubly wronged by what's happening here?
Well, you know, I get it. You know, I can't tell you how frustrated I was to be there with folks who thought that this was somehow going to end well, and that it was a perfectly appropriate thing to do to shut down the government and even threaten to not pay our bills in order to get what they wanted. And as long as we have those kinds of sort of hostage politics, it's going to be very, very difficult. And, you know, nationally, when you look, part of the reason why we have this is because we have these districts, congressional districts around the country, where people are so insulated from a challenge on the other side of the aisle that they only play to their hardcore base. And that's going to be something that it's going to take some time to work through. I think a number of these folks are going to have very challenging re-elections. But it won't be until things get redistricted in 2020 that we really see, hopefully, districts that represent, that look a little bit more like America writ large.
We're talking today with New Mexico's United States Senator Martin Heinrich, and there are several ways for you to join in our discussion. You may email comments to callinshow@kunm.org. You may post comments on the Call In Show webpage. You may call our local number, 277-5866. That's 277-KUNM. Or our toll-free number, 1-877-899-5866, with questions and comments. Let's go ahead and bring in our next caller who's been holding for some time. It's Philip from Albuquerque. Good morning, Philip.
Good morning.
Hello, Philip.
Hello, good morning. I'd like to ask the senator how the Congress is going to address the need for campaign finance reform that, in my mind, makes it so that the corporations call the public agenda more than the voters do. It's really the big banks and the big corporations that are pushing for free trade, that's sending our jobs overseas. We're seeing the wealthy get wealthier and the middle class shrink. And I think it's because the politicians have to cater to the corporate money to get reelected. And this needs reform because we don't have democracy anymore, as former President Carter has recently pointed out. And what do you say about that, sir?
I agree with you. I think campaign finance reform is one of the things that could really create a much more functional government in this country. The challenge that I see is less in the legislative body. It's really been in the Supreme Court. And one of my focuses going forward is going to be to make sure that as we put justices on the Supreme Court, that they don't hold this view that money equals free speech and that corporations are people. Because every major step forward in campaign finance reform in recent years has been wiped clean by this Supreme Court by a 5-4 majority in most cases. And we've seen that time and again with the Citizens United decision. It goes all the way back to Buckley versus Vallejo when they said that basically money equals free speech. And we've been paying a price for that ever since. I think for us to get campaign finance reform that will be meaningful and that will survive challenge, we're going to have to see a different viewpoint represented on the Supreme Court in the majority to be able to get there. When I was on the Albuquerque City Council, we were able through a ballot referendum to get public financing. But you have to invest in that and you have to make sure it's competitive. And now we have these huge outside corporate PACs and I mean, the outside money in any given election used to be what was raised by the candidates sort of dominated the election. Now you have these groups come in, oftentimes have no real ties to the community whatsoever, and what they're spending completely eclipses what the candidates are spending. So you're absolutely right, and I think our focus needs to be on the courts to make sure that we get back to something closer to one person, one vote.
You say we have to wait sort of for a sea change on the Supreme Court, but is there anything that you as a senator could do to take things in a different direction?
You know, I've co-sponsored legislation to implement public financing, but I really worry that anything that we do, even things that were as incremental as the McCain-Feingold legislation, have not survived this Supreme Court. And so until we fix that problem, I worry that even those good things that we can pass, and I'm going to be very blunt here, in this divided Congress, I don't see public financing moving forward. We made a strong push for it in 2009 and 2010. In this Congress, it's not going to happen because there's no support on the Republican side of the aisle today. There used to be, and there is not today. But if we were able to get that in place, I would worry that it would be struck down by the Supreme Court.
Okay. Well, we've got an issue in the state here. I'm sure you've heard education that people are very hot on right now. And we are going to go to a break, but we've got people weighing in on Twitter. We've got people sending email comments. We've got a caller. We're going to get to our caller on education right after the break. But let me go ahead and just read the questions that have come in both on Twitter and email. Bosque Dave asks on Twitter, what is your view of No Child Left Behind on teacher evaluations? And then we have an email question from Emily Floyd. How do you propose to increase the quality of education in New Mexico. We're going to go to our break, but just you get a chance to sit with those questions.
Right.
We'll take a call from Jane from Sandia Park when we come back. But let's take a quick break right now. We're talking with Senator Martin Heinrich, and we'll be right back with you.
Find out how Rio Grande School challenges, inspires, and nurtures children from age 3 through 6th grade at the admissions open house Thursday, November 7th, starting promptly at 8:30 a.m. Rio Grande School offers small classes led by two teachers. Along with rigorous academics, students enjoy the arts, physical education, technology, Spanish, and experiential learning. Info at riograndeschool.org or call 983-1621. A message from the tax-exempt Rio Grande School.
This is Alex Chadwick from Bern. Near the top of the world in Greenland, the ice is melting.
We wanted to see and hear the ice as it crashes off a glacier. That process is called calving.
As the glaciers melt, the seas rise in New York, in Miami, and in New Orleans.
Now you can see one of the great cities of the world as it sinks below the sea.
Rising Seas, the next edition of Bern from Sound Division Productions and APM.
Sunday morning at 11 on 89.9 KUNM.
Welcome back to the KUNM Call-In Show. I'm Kathleen Sabo, and this morning we're talking with United States Senator Martin Heinrich. You may join us on email, Twitter, or through the telephone. And now joining us by telephone is Jane from Sandia Park. And Jane, I hope you were able to hear the Twitter question and the email question that came in from some of our listeners. And I'm wondering how you would like to add to those questions or this discussion.
Well, my sister has been a longtime public school teacher, and I have never seen her so stressed and depressed as she is right now. Teachers absolutely want to be evaluated, but the current evaluation system, which has been developed by not the actual elected Secretary of Education for New Mexico, but the designee, who has no education background, and implemented these same reforms in Florida, and it destroyed the Florida schools. It's just a mess right now, and I just would like to know what Mr. Heinrich thinks about how public schools are being completely destroyed, and many people feel that is the intent of what's going on right now. So I would just like to know what he thinks about what's happening right now, and I will hang up and listen.
Thanks so much, Jane. Go right ahead, Senator.
Well, let's start by thanking your sister and all teachers and public education professionals throughout the state. I'm deeply disturbed by a certain element of the political class that thinks that somehow we're going to reform education by continually beating up on the people who take very tough jobs and who labor in the trenches every day to educate our children. My kids have gone to public school their entire lives. I went to public school my entire education, and we need to make this system function. And that starts with a certain amount of respect and gratitude for the people that work so hard in that system. I think the problems that you're seeing that you alluded to with evaluation really go back to this issue of No Child Left Behind that Dave brought up and how that law is structured. There are a number of problems with it. It's something that needs to be rewritten. I think we need to get rid of No Child Left Behind and renew the Elementary and Secondary Education Act closer to its original intent. And I'll give you some examples of how it's failing New Mexico students. If you take a fifth grade teacher and that fifth grade teacher has a child come into class who's reading at the second grade level, and when they leave at the end of the year, they're reading at the fourth grade level. Because they didn't make grade level, that is viewed under No Child Left Behind as a failure. But those are exactly the teachers we want to be saying we want to be encouraging. I mean, they're moving kids multiple grade levels, but it doesn't recognize that some of the kids coming in are so far behind grade level to begin with that at the end of the year, they're not going to be at the fifth grade level. So we need a growth-based testing and evaluation system that doesn't just test so that some company can make a lot of money off of the test booklets, but gives testing at the beginning of the year that educates the teacher on what individual students need in terms of their instruction, and then looks at those same students at the end of the year so that you know what kind of progress that you're making. And all of that testing should be so that the teacher can adjust their instruction to individual students. And No Child Left Behind just isn't doing that. It's painting a very broad brush over a very diverse state with diverse challenges in education. And I think we can do a lot better.
You know, there's so many levels to this education issue, and people are really distressed. Our superintendent here in Albuquerque sent an email out begging teachers not to quit. There was this race to the top aspect of things where people were desperate for cash and they sort of agreed onto it and they had to agree to a curriculum. How likely is this to come up soon in the House or the Senate and to see some changes?
It is something that we have been holding hearings on and wrestling with for several years. But I don't want to give people the impression that under the, you know, with some of the current members we have, making positive changes would be very, very challenging. And I think that states are one place where we can have more of an impact in the short term, but we need to not lose sight of the fact that we really do, at the federal level, need to rewrite our education policy, support parents, support teachers, and support schools.
All right. We have a call from Bob from Las Vegas who has a question on drones. Welcome, Bob. Thanks for calling.
Good morning. Senator, you've no doubt heard about the report that was produced a couple of days ago from Amnesty International in which they investigated a number of attacks, I think 50-some, by drones by the U.S. in Pakistan, with a suggestion that there's the possibility that some of those attacks may constitute war crimes. Now, you're a member of the Intelligence Committee. Do you think that the Intelligence Committee will hold hearings on that report and investigate what has happened, and would you support that?
Well, absolutely, we are looking at that report, and in fact, my staff is already digging into that report. I think anything that we can do that increases transparency and deals with the issues broadly of making sure that anytime we are engaged around the world and you have, whether it's in Afghanistan or anywhere else, you have civilians who get caught up in these conflicts. Anything that can be done to minimize that is absolutely necessary. And I've always urged additional transparency on these issues. There's not a lot I can say. It's a very frustrating place to be sometimes on the Intelligence Committee because I can't speak on a lot of the details. But I can tell you that we are very much wrestling with challenging issues like this every day, including this report. And also issues around what NSA has been doing. You know, I've been very active with a number of my colleagues, with Mark Udall up in Colorado and Ron Wyden out on the West Coast, saying that we think that what NSA has been doing, what you've been reading about in the press, goes beyond the intent of legislation that was passed and is certainly not in accordance with how I view the fact that the founders got it right in the Fourth Amendment. And I think we need, there's a lot of work that we need to do to make sure that we get back closer to the ideal that the founders set in the Fourth Amendment in terms of how we do surveillance or any other data collection. And I'm certainly on several pieces of legislation to try and reform those things.
As a way of transitioning to healthcare-related questions, we have a question an email question from a listener, Katie Stone, who wonders, will you sponsor the ABLE Act for people with disabilities creating tax-free savings accounts?
We actually have that bill in our legislative shop right now, and we're trying to figure out I don't have an answer just right off the bat. We're still evaluating it, and we're trying to look at also it deals with some areas, but leaves some other very relevant. It's a little bit of a silo effect where it fixes one part of the law, but it doesn't do it as broadly as we would like. And so we're trying to figure out what the right path forward is. But it's something we're very actively looking at right now.
All right. And we want to bring in our next caller. It's Valerie from Chimayo, who I believe has a problem with the individual mandate portion of the Affordable Care Act. Go ahead, Valerie. You're on the air.
Hi. On C-SPAN, I watched the Senate free vote cloture right before the shutdown when every Democratic senator there voted only to move the individual mandate for a year for a clean resolution on borrowing for a year, then changed their minds on the official vote, hence the government shutdown. It's been said the mandate is necessary because without it, young adults who are supposedly all healthy won't pay for health insurance to help support those with chronic conditions. Well, I think that's delusional because young adults have babies, get into more car accidents, need dental care, have more drug problems, and have many more malnutrition-related diseases. I'm sure without the individual mandate, young adults would buy health insurance if it were affordable.
Well, I can't really comment on the on the cloture vote. I'm not sure what you're referencing there because it doesn't exactly square with my memory. But on the issue of the individual mandate, without that piece, the other pieces of the bill don't work. You have a situation where if people are not having health insurance and then they go into the emergency room and have tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of uncompensated care, that uncompensated care still gets paid for by all of us, whether it's passed through in your taxes to the county and paying for UNMH here in Albuquerque, or whether it's passed along to most insurance companies, which, you know, charge you about, I think the figure is something like $1,500 to $2,000 a year to pay for the uncompensated care that's out there. Those costs are very real, and they get passed on. And so what the individual mandate allows for is to get everybody in the system and get them receiving health care much earlier in the process. So receiving primary care instead of getting health care in the emergency room. And, you know, something as simple as, you know, tonsillitis, if you don't deal with it early on and you end up in the ER, the cost of dealing with sickness go up exponentially when you get to emergency care. And so this pushes the whole healthcare model back towards the primary care model. You know, UNMH here in New Mexico is well known nationwide for their focus on primary care because it holds down costs. And New Mexico has been a real leader as a result in holding costs down by focusing earlier in the healthcare cycle on primary care. And by having that individual mandate, we're able to extend health care to several hundred thousand people in the state of New Mexico who didn't formerly have health care and were all too often getting that health care in the emergency room.
I've heard people suggest that the Affordable Care Act in its current formation is just a stopgap, really a way to get people in the system with a focus coming perhaps not just on primary care, but on preventive care, on well-being, on nutrition. How likely are we to see tweaks to the Affordable Care Act?
Very likely. And you never, you know, healthcare is one of those things that most changes to it are very incremental. And we've already seen changes to the Affordable Care Act, like the 1099 rule filing for small businesses. And you'll continue to see those kinds of tweaks over time. I think what you'll see resistance to is the attempt to simply wipe it off the books the way that Senator Ted Cruz and others attempted to during the government shutdown. But you will see changes. There's no question. Some things will work very, very well. Some things won't. You know, we're in a situation right now where it seems that the underlying health care insurance product that's being offered in these exchanges seems to be very sound. People are, even here in New Mexico, small businesses are signing up. But you have the administration has a web portal that is dysfunctional, and there's no excuse for that. So, you know, they need to fix that piece of it. I think the good news is that the underlying insurance product being offered through these exchanges seems to be something that could dramatically change healthcare in this country for the better.
Okay, let's move on to our next caller. It's Chuck from Albuquerque. Good morning, Chuck. Thank you for joining us.
Good morning. Good morning, Martin.
Good morning.
Hi, I'm Chuck Buxbaum, and I'm a teacher at Sandia Prep. And my students at Sandia Prep have done a study on the Rio Grande Bosque in follow-up to the mayor's plan, which includes a lot of development that's pretends to reduce wildlife values and ecosystem values in the bosque, planning to put in large paths and clear areas for development of other facilities. And my students, I had them do a study looking at urban riparian areas around the country and to find other cities that have intact urban forests. And there are none in the United States other than Albuquerque. I think the only city that comes close is Fairbanks, Alaska, which isn't really a big city. And one of the thoughts that we had is it possible, if this is so unique, does that qualify our Rio Grande State Park possibly for national monument status, because we have an intact riparian forest running the length of our city? And I thought that would be an incredible way to preserve its values for forever. What do you think of that proposal, and what do you think of the mayor's plan in general?
Well, first, Chuck, let me say how much I appreciate the work that your students are doing, because that's the kind of engagement that will make sure that we have an outdoors that is worthy of our kids and our grandkids, and that we don't lose those things that are so special about this place. Because the Bosque through Albuquerque is not federal land, I'm not sure that it's a good fit for the Antiquities Act. But I would say that I love that Bosque. It's one of the things I truly enjoy about Albuquerque. And it's important for people to remember that it wasn't always that way. If you just think back maybe 15 years ago, you would walk down to the Bosque and it would be absolutely choked with Russian olive and tamarisk, two completely non-native species. You couldn't see 10 yards in many places in the middle of Albuquerque in the Bosque. And through a lot of really diligent work that was done over the years, you know, I was the natural resources trustee at one point, and we were doing Bosque clearing work. The city of Albuquerque invested an enormous amount of money in going in and getting rid of the non-natives and letting the natives come back and really thrive and opening up that Bosque. And one of the things it did is it brought people back into the Bosque. You could walk around almost anywhere. You weren't limited to that narrow little path. And I think that that is a great resource, just like it is right now.
Senator, at the top of the program, I asked you if there was anything that you would be upset about or regretful if we didn't mention, and one of those was immigration reform. And I know we were at the close of our program, but if you wanted to take a minute or a half a minute just to tell us where you are on that and why you think it's important for New Mexico.
I think it's absolutely critical for New Mexico and for New Mexico's economy. We've made so much progress so far on immigration reform to see a bipartisan bill come out of the Senate. I certainly hope we can keep the focus on it and get the House of Representatives to act. Now's the time to get this done.
Well, hopefully we'll have you back in the future to talk more about that topic and others. Thanks to our guest, Senator Martin Heinrich, for making himself available to our listeners today. And thanks to our callers for helping to develop our discussion. Apologies to any callers we did not get to. Thanks to our engineer, Jefferson White, and our assistant producer, Kaveh Movahed. Andy Lyman has handled our phones today. Elaine Baumgartle is our executive producer. I'm Kathleen Sabo. This has been the KUNM Call-In Show on KUNM, news and music that connect from the University of New Mexico.